This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alice Randall, has written what she describes as a parody of Gone with the Wind, the 1936 novel by Margaret Mitchell. Gone with the Wind told the story of plantation life in the South from a white slave owner's perspective. Randall's new book, The Wind Done Gone, reinterprets the story from the slave's point of view. The Margaret Mitchell estate tried to prevent the publication of The Wind Done Gone, arguing that the book was an unauthorized sequel and therefore a violation of copyright. The publisher says it's a parody, which is protected by the First Amendment. The Mitchell estate won the first round in court, getting an injunction blocking publication of Randall's book. But in late May, that injunction was overturned. And although the case is still in the courts, the book has just been published. The Wind Done Gone is Alice Randall's first novel. She's also the only African-American woman to have written a number one country music hit. I asked her what Gone with the Wind meant to her when she first read it.
I first read Gone with the Wind when I was about 12 years old. I was living in Washington, D.C., and I found the book shocking. I did not know until I read that book that there was any person who was smart enough to write a book who thought the Klan was a positive organization. I didn't really know that there were people who had a sustained view that black people were intellectually inferior until I read Gone with the Wind. So it was shocking. At the same time, I was attracted to parts of the romantic tale.
Why did the book continue to matter to you enough to take it seriously enough to write a parody on and to spend so much time on it?
Well, you know, I'm speaking to you from Nashville, and I live in the South. I think that I have found in my life that Gone with the Wind, the book, has come back literally to haunt me time after time, that people have quoted the book to me, quoted from the book. I have come across many people whose opinions and impressions about certain aspects of Southern history and, more importantly, certain aspects of the African-American character seem to have been meaningfully influenced by Gone with the Wind.
Can you give me a sense of a time when somebody quoted the book at you?
Oh, I've had people say often when there's a question of doing something, taking an action, and I hesitate for a moment. I don't know nothing about birthing no babies, Miss Scarlett. Literally.
Right.
I had a woman tell me today at my signing that she used to say that to her mother when her mother asked her to do any kind of housework. Because the phrase has become a kind of shorthand to speak of black incompetence. And even more complicatedly, it is sometimes used as a shorthand to speak of black incompetence in the face of the assertion of competence, the prior assertion of competence. Prissy says she knows all about birthing babies, but finally she doesn't. I think that's a particularly damaging structure. The assertion of competence followed by this incompetence.
When you were an undergraduate at Harvard, you wrote your honors thesis on mothers and daughters in Jane Austen's fiction. And in a way, your new book, The Wind Done Gone, is also a book about mothers and daughters, but it's about mothers and daughters and mammies. Why don't you explain what I mean by that?
Well, Cinera has two mothers. She has a biological mother, Mammy, who doesn't mother her at all, who mothers rather other.
Other's the Scarlett O'Hara figure.
Exactly. And Cinera actually finds her mothering, receives her literal mother's milk from Lady, the white aristocratic wife of her biological father, Planter. So she has both a white and a black mother. The white mother is not her biological mother, but is her emotional mother. And the black mother, at least to her childish view, is her biological mother, but not her emotional mother.
In part because her black mother, who's a biological mother, is so busy being the mammy to the white daughters on the plantation.
Exactly, other. And in fact, you know, the thing that inspired me most to write this book, in a sense, was that Mammy is perhaps the most vivid portrait of a mother in all of American literature. And it is a black mother that is co-opted completely to mothering only a white child. Mammy is not only asexual, which many people have commented on. The Mammy of Gone with the Wind is afertile. She doesn't have a child of her own at all. It's a complete co-opting of the image of the Black mother. One, the central act of my parody is to give Mammy a child, and then to give that child, Cinera, a voice. But that child, that voice, could not exist in the other text. It points out the absurdity of the other text.
Let's go over some of the characters in your book, The Wind Done Gone. Let's start with the narrator. Who narrates the story in your novel?
Cinera. She is a mulatto woman, a not-so-tragic mulatto woman, who is very intelligent and who, in a meaningful way, reads and writes her way into being. She is writing a diary and coming to terms with herself as she lives and writes of her life.
And she is the daughter of the owner of the plantation.
She's the daughter of a planter, a white aristocratic plant, well, not aristocratic, a white planter and a mammy on a plantation.
Okay.
Planter and mammy.
And Scarlet, the character who we know as Scarlet in Gone with the Wind, who is she in your parody?
The Scarlet analog, if you will, is a character called Other, who has no other name than Other.
And what did you name her Other?
I chose the word Other for three reasons. One is because the word Other is actually a subset of the word Mother. And that is one of the places I want to emphasize that Other is important only as a pawn in this other relationship between Cinera and Mammy. Also, you know, as you well know, the word Other comes out of feminist criticism and is used for the rejected self, the other, the mad woman in the attic, if you, in the Jane Eyre story, is also the other, often used with the word the in front of it, the article the, is a word that certain Black psychologists and sociologists have used, a phrase, to suggest the rejected social identity of Black people as being the other in society, where we project some of our darker desires and ideas. So I have reversed all three, you know, of those things in my novel. The same way Mammy was a character in the other book, Other is a caricature in this book.
And what are some of her qualities?
She has very few qualities.
Okay. So she's just a little blank stereotype of a white woman on a plantation.
Yes. I've stripped her of her sexuality, her attractiveness, and her work. So she's not much of her left.
Okay. And the Rhett Butler character, who is he in your novel?
R.
And what is he like?
Well, the significant difference between the two is R is willing to marry a Black woman, which I don't think Rhett Butler would ever have done. Also, R is definitely over the hill aging. This is a very cynical look at R.
Are there things about your own background that you were kind of wondering out loud about in writing The Wind Done Gone?
Well, I am examining my own experience of reading this text. So there is that experience of reading. And one of the things that has interested me greatly is that most African-Americans that I personally know, and particularly women, reading is a very, very important part of their lives. And part of the African-American tradition coming out of the South is a tradition of reading, partially because if you imagine back in the 50s and the 40s, if you were a Black child in the South in the summertime, there were no such things as summer jobs except for working out in a field or in someone's house. There were no summer camps. You couldn't go to the swimming pool. You couldn't eat in the local restaurant. And so often what kids would do, and certainly what I did in the summers of when I was young, is to read every day. I mean, that's what was available to you. And so I wanted to work on a book that depicted my experience of growing up, which was largely an experience of reading. And so that was something important to my own experience. In my own family, I have a number of my relations, including my mother, whose father was white. My father's parents, my grandparents, my grandmother and grandfather, both were half Black, half white. So I have a lot of experience with, in my own family, of intermarriage and racial dynamics acted out in families.
Have you gone through different stages in your feelings about the white parts of your ancestry.
Yes, I have. And I think, that first stage was ignorance. When I was a very little girl, I didn't know that I had any, white relations. I learned that I had white relations about the very same time when I was 4 or 5, that I learned that I had black relations in Alabama who could not vote because, I remember the day that my cousins in Alabama were able to vote for the very first time. That was in my lifetime. That's not something prior to my history. That's a part of my history. And around that same time that we were talking about Alabama, I was told about my father's ancestry. And it's interesting, my grandfather could not read or write to the day he died, much more than his name. And so illiteracy is very important to my family, and literacy is very important to my family. My grandfather turned out to be a successful man and a very active father and active husband. So in some odd ways, my grandmother could never put but so much value in reading and writing. But ultimately, it was the one thing. My grandfather was also one who would thump me on the head and say, education is the only thing they can't take away from you. So I think that it's interesting about my experience in race relations. One of the central tensions in my feeling about race is the way, as the story was told to me originally, the reason my grandfather could not read or write is because his white father would not allow anyone to teach him, and that he was a very prominent and important man, wealthy man in the community in which he lived, and that he intimidated everyone away from teaching my grandfather how to read and write as a way of maintaining some control over my grandfather. And in our own personal family story, he gave my grandfather no education but money and land. And so it sort of created a bias in our family, I think, away from materialism and towards education as the thing to be sought for.
My guest is Alice Randall. Her new novel, The Wind Done Gone, is a parody of the 1936 novel, Gone with the Wind. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alice Randall. Her new novel, The Wind Done Gone, is a parody of the 1936 novel, Gone with the Wind. Now, you are so absorbed in the South, both through country music and through writing The Wind Done Gone, your parody of Gone with the Wind, but you grew up in Detroit, which is the North. Are there certain stories that your parents or grandparents told you about the South that stuck with you and helped define your image of the South when you were a child living in the North?
Yes, one of the most memorable is my father describing going back down South after he lived in Detroit and went to high school there when he was drafted and went to the Army. And he said he'd get on the train and they'd be gambling and talking and drinking from Detroit to Chicago. And in Chicago, they would change trains and head south. And he would tell me about the men, grown men, Army men, crying in the night because they were going back into segregation, into Jim Crow segregation.
Did that scare you from going to the South?
I hesitate to answer because the answer is yes. I was afraid of the South a lot. I grew up with fear and courage. I grew up with fear and taught to not back down in the face of that fear. So the South was really something my father rejected. A sweet story is when I graduated from Harvard, my father wanted to meet Derek Bach, who was the president of Harvard University at the time. And I said, Daddy, everybody wants or doesn't want to meet Derek Bach. This man does not know me. He's not going to want to meet us at my graduation. But he insisted, and I called the office, and he agreed to meet with us a couple days before the graduation. And we went and stood beneath the statue of John Harvard. And what my father said to Derek Bach was that he was going to forgive America. Because he was going to forgive America for giving me this Harvard education, that it wasn't something he could buy or achieve or give me, that it was something the university, that America had to give me. and that he was making his peace with America over the opportunity I had to be educated at Harvard. And after that, my father went back down south. He actually went back and stood in the river in which he had been baptized as a boy. But you have to remember that my father says he had never worn shoes until he was 13 or 14 years old, and he wasn't born in the last century. He was born in this century. Do you remember I was with my father when our relations down south got to vote for the first time, and that he knew his own grandfather who would not let his father learn to read or write. So my father had a lot of issues with America. He was a Malcolm X radical. I used to tell people, when in country music, they say, how can you deal with all the racist in country music? First of all, there aren't many racist in country music. But second was, I said, I was raised by a racist. And I tried to redeem that racist and teach my father to love people regardless of the color of their skin. I think I achieved some of that. But he had a passionate hatred of the South. And strangely enough, I've got a passionate love of it because it is the land that created him in all of his complexity.
Was your father educated? Had he gone to college or even high school?
He graduated from high school and did part of a year or about a year of college before he came home to help my grandparents in their family business. And so he really did not have or take the opportunity. He was more about to get a complete education. He's a very, very smart man. He read tremendously every day, lots of books, lots of newspapers. He was the kind of man who would wake you up at 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning to go get, or before that, newspapers off the line in Detroit. Read, two, three, four newspapers a day and, several books a week sometimes. And when I was writing my thesis on Jane Austen, my father was very much what you call a Detroit sort of street guy. He owned dry cleaners. He knew people high and low. He knew he was very much a man grounded in the street, but who had achieved a lot. And he read all those Jane Austen novels when I was writing my thesis on Jane Austen. He was a tremendously loving and literate father.
When you moved to Nashville to write country songs, did you love country music, or did you just see it as a good forum?
No, I loved country music, and this is one of those strange things. When I was in college, I was typing a very long screenplay once, and I started listening to country music as a joke, frankly. But when I was listening to it, I was at that point really interested in 17th century Puritan sermons and some of the early American metaphysical poetry, Edward Taylor, who was sort of the cousins of John Donne. And I noticed in an image, there's a song out about that time called Coca-Cola Cowboy, that this was essentially a metaphysical image in the sense that the 17th century poets used them. And I became intrigued with some of the strategies of country music and a sense of what I perceived as dynamic stasis. I love that song, He Stopped Loving Her Today, where there is not, in all of Western literature, the hero develops, the hero grows. Well, there is a strain in country music, which I call dynamic stasis, where no change occurs at all. The only change is death, and the narrator moves around this fixed object of a life. And Mama's Hungry Eyes, Merle Haggard, is another example of that. I don't recall a change of any size. So I was fascinated by the strategies of country music, and I was fascinated by, and this is sort of relates to my dilemma right now, the degree to which educated intellectual people perceive the art form as being ignorant, stupid, limited, that people feel it very free to make fun of country music, whereas I personally believe that some of the great poetry of our time appears in country songs as well as blues songs.
Well, I want to play a song that you wrote, and this is a song that Trish Yearwood recorded. It's called X's and O's, or An American Girl. You want to say anything about the song?
I wrote this song in a very desperate day when my daughter needed something and my work needed something completely different. And I thought everything was failing and falling apart. And I literally was in the shower and I thought, you've got a picture of your mom in heels and pearls. You're trying to make it in your daddy's world. You're not going to do it, girl. And I thought, that is a song I need to write right now. And I literally came up with a few other little things. I was working very hard on something. I put on a lot of weight. So if you notice the beginning of it, phone rings, TV diet guru lies. There was that strange one with the white hair out then. So I think of the two things that helped me get through, and they are, in that song, Aretha Franklin and Patsy Cline. And I was so thrilled that we could get Aretha Franklin and Patsy Cline in song. And also, I put in She's Got Her God and She's Got Good Wine. And I have a religious sensibility, which is often, again, looked down upon from people who are very intellectual. And so I wanted to be honest to that, too. So we put God and wine and Aretha and Patsy Cline in the song. So I actually like it a lot, although it has a Diddy-like frame on the outside.
Okay, and this is Trish Yearwood singing a song by Alice Randall, and I believe you have a co-writer on the song, too.
The brilliant Matresa Berg, who wrote Fake in Love when she was still a teenage girl, and she's a brilliant, brilliant writer.
Well, Alice Randall, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Good morning, honey. Go to work, make up, try to keep the balance up between love and money. She used to tie her hair up in ribbons and bows, sign her letters with X's and O's. Got a picture of her mama in heels and pearls. She's trying to make it in her daddy's world. She's an American girl. An American girl. Slow dance, second chance, mama.
Alice Randall's new novel, The Wind Done Gone, is a parody of Gone with the Wind. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.